Well, I want to welcome those of you that were not here last night and say that what I'll do for those of you that were not here last night is a kind of a quick little summary along the way of a few key points that I made last night. But that'll happen briskly and in the flow, and hopefully it won't be boring or anything for those of you that were here last night. So a bit about myself. I'm a neuropsychologist, a clinical psychologist, a methods guy in the trenches. I consume a lot of research. I think of myself sometimes like a baleen whale, you know, sieving cubic miles of seawater for the plankton or something. But I don't produce any research. I'm very interested in getting to the essences in the research literature and applying it, translating it for both everyday well-being and healing of pain and spiritual practice. So our topic today is the profundity, really, of who am I? We've all asked that question, right, at one time or another. Who am I? Well, what is this? And to the Buddha and to others in the world's great contemplative traditions, this is a very fundamental question. We're going to explore it in as down-to-earth a way as possible, because it's very easy to get very sort of lofty or transcendental or mystical or intellectual about it, conceptual about it. And I want to bring it down as much as possible into our actual experiencing. That's how the Buddha engaged this particular question. And see what modern neuroscience can tell us about this fundamental and very intimate matter of me, myself, and I. Right? I think there are a lot of areas where brain science, even though it's kind of glittery these days, really offers no value. And it's important, I think, to be a little careful of the old wine in new bottles phenomenon, whereby, for example, sometimes simply describing things in a neurological way may seem impressive, right? If you want to sell a book these days, put brain in the title. Not that I would ever do that. On the other hand, just because, for example, we can say, well, my amygdala activated when you said that to me, rather than, I got really pissed off when you said that to me. Do we know anything more that the amygdala, the alarm bell of the brain, activated? Well, if you're a neuroscientist and you're trying to link experiential processes to underlying physiological activities, okay, that's useful. But in everyday life, we've just moved the level of explanation down, and it confers no pragmatic benefit. It doesn't help us in any useful way, right? And so I think it's important to kind of be careful about that glittery, seductive allure of the secular religion in the West, which is, of course, science. If you want to sell used cars, put on a white lab coat, and sales will go up if you drape a stethoscope around your neck as well. On the other hand, there are places where I think neuroscience really does add value. And this is one of them, as we'll see. When you look at MRI images, which I'll show you, which attempt to locate self in the brain, I in the brain, and the scientists can't do that. And in fact, the various activations that seem related to self-related functions, like knowing that this is mine and that's yours, or picking a photograph of oneself out of a group of people, or... declaring yourself on an important value, like eating meat or not, that those particular activations in the brain that are related to those multiple psychological functions that seem very intimate to me, right, are scattered all over the brain. There's no place in the brain where self is located. And that has a lot of implications. So this is one area where I think neuroscience can make some real contributions. So my plan for today is to have this be roughly about a third experiential and about two-thirds presentation discussion. That's kind of how it always turns out to be. I always like doing more experiential stuff, but this material in particular is really furthered through insight, through understanding, through kind of penetrating clarity about the nature of things, discernment, and inevitably people want to talk about it, which is perfectly fine. So that's generally my intention. I'll take a break in the morning, as has been said, and also in the afternoon, as well as a lunch break. You're also very welcome just to support yourself. Get up. If you're falling asleep, feel free to stand up, in the back of the room, ideally. It's okay to lie down if you want to. It won't bother me. If you want to get up at times other than the break to use the bathroom or get some food or something to drink, perfectly fine as well. Okay. A little detail, this is being recorded by White Heron Sangha, and it will be made available to people in this organization. And I've been told that I can post it myself on my own website, which is a public website. So basically, I've also been told that your voices are almost impossible to hear on this recording. But think about that a little bit, if you're going to share something that's pretty personal. And so I'm assuming that this is okay. I always feel it's important to ask people's permission to run a recording. Anybody have a difficulty with us recording this? I'm also very happy to talk with you individually at the breaks or at lunch or stick around afterwards. On Sunday, I have to zip out of here fairly quickly after the workshop. But this evening, I can stick around a bit and talk with people. Okay? Okay, so we're going to record this. Okay, good. Last little detail. I'll happily send you a PDF of these slides, which you're welcome to use however you like. And to do that, though, I need your name and email address. I will not share your name and email address with anyone ever. And you can always get off my list anytime you want. And unless you say on this little yellow pad outside, unless you say just slides, I'll automatically subscribe you to my little practice newsletter called Just One Thing, which Michael mentioned. It's a practice newsletter. It's about little things we can do 1 week, basically. The one this week is Rest Your Weary Head. The previous week was Enjoy Now, about this great mystery of this moment. What is it actually? They tend to be pretty down to earth. Enjoy your hands, give thanks, see the being behind the eyes, whatever. Apologize and admit fault and move on, things like that. So 36,000 people actually subscribe to it. And so you're very welcome to subscribe to it as well, or unsubscribe if you want to. And so to get to your name and email address, there's a yellow pad or yellow sheets, rather, out on the registration table. Okay. So that's it for the logistics. Yeah?
If you signed up last night, do you need to sign up again?
No, I'll send you the whole kit and caboodle. Yeah. Good question. Okay. Okay? All right, good. Let's get to it. So, this is my topic. Anatta is the traditional word for not soul. And I'm going to give a little explanation here of anatta. Okay, here we go. We're already in the deep end of the pool. So, when the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, he did so in a context. And by the way, as a sidebar, there's a really wonderful book that's been written by Richard Gombrich called What the Buddha Thought. It's absurdly expensive on Amazon. Even though it's a thin paperback, it's like $87 from his monographs. I got it less expensively. I don't know, the price seems to have risen. I bet you can find it cheaper than that somewhere. But it's really a marvelous book about what the Buddha was thinking, his underlying take on things, that this great scholar, Gombrich, is the semi-retired emeritus, mucky-muck scholar of Buddhist languages in Oxford. He's the highest level kind of guy. And he's a cranky, opinionated person, so he's fun to read. Anyway, so as Gombrich points out, and others have as well, so the Buddha taught in a tradition, and at his time, the sort of Hindu/Jain tradition of his time believed quite commonly that there was an Atman, a soul essence that just was there. It was always there, and it will always be there, and it migrated from life to life to life. All right? And the Buddhist argument was no, that, pardon me, actually, everything is process. There's nothing but processes. One of his central metaphors was that of a flame. A flame is a process that arises and passes away due to underlying causes. Logs, fuel, sparks, rain, smothering, the nature of the fuel. All those causes result in the moment-to-moment emergence of phenomena. And then as those causes change, the phenomena changes. So changing phenomena reflect changing causes. And in this model, things were the result of causes. And things could be influenced by changing the causes. So that was his overall frame. So in that frame, he argued against essences. In other words, he had a problem with, that's probably not the right way to put it, but he felt it wasn't true that there was this irreducible Atman that moved from body to body, and that the nature of the birth, body to body to body, in terms of reincarnation, was due to actions. He believed that the fundamental causal process that was available to us as humans had to do with intention. It wasn't just that we could do an empty ritual, like a puja, and have that, or pay a priest some money, or give the priest some flowers or food or whatever. It wasn't that that is what would lead to a better birth. What would lead to a better birth, and also what would lead to more results in this life, were what we did based on our intentions. So for him, it was not the case that there was this irreducible essence that was what it was, regardless of our intentions, but rather that there was a stream of causal processes moving through an individual life, and in his model, from life to life to life, from birth to birth to birth. So he argued against this notion of an irreducible soul essence that had absolute existence, right? His argument was that everything arose due to causes in an interdependent kind of frame, in a vast network of causes. A metaphor that works for me, having been a kind of an outdoor guy, is an eddy in a stream, a swirling collection that you see of twigs and leaves and water swirling together, moving downstream. Or imagine a standing wave as a river moves over a boulder. The constituents of that pattern, the standing wave, are continually changing, even though the wave itself has some continuity over time. But even eventually it, as the larger conditions change, you know, as the river changes its flow or ices up or dries up as, you know, the eons pass, that standing wave will change too, right? And so, okay. So that's the basic idea of, that's the original notion of anatman, which a means not, not atman. That notion of not a soul then got extended in more conventional ways into the idea that there's not an abiding personal essence in us, a being, a unified essence that looks out through the eyes. And I'll get to this a little bit later. In other words, the Buddha, his teachings and the way his teachings were interpreted moved from a kind of metaphysical stance, which you can agree or disagree with. You know, the Buddha was right or wrong about whether or not there's an irreducible soul essence, okay? But that's a fairly metaphysical argument, right? That got extended down now to the level of psychology, everyday psychology. And the position there is that there is no essential, unified, enduring, independent essence of personality, the I who I really am. Right? And we'll get to that much more. But you see the distinction? Now I'm moving to the level of psychology. Okay? There are persons, as I'll get to more later. There are individuals that have certain qualities. Right? Michael is different from Rick. There are differences here. But the Buddhist argument is that the very common notion, the assumption, especially in the West, that there's an irreducible I or me, a being, a being is an entity looking out through the eyes, the owner of experiences and the agent of actions, is not true. Okay? And then that idea, which is also under the general heading of anatta, in the Mahayana tradition that arose several centuries, it had its beginning several centuries after the Buddha passed away. It really arose five, six, seven centuries later. The Mahayana tradition, as Buddhism moved into Tibet, and then through Tibet, China, and then Japan, with particularly the contribution of early philosophers like Nagarjuna, extended the notion of anatta to everything. So the emphasis in that teaching is that even things like the slight projector do not have an irreducible absolute essence. That everything, both materiality, the stuff out here, and in particular our experience of it, our perception of it, or idea about it, or feelings about it, you know, the realm of experience, that too is comprised of many elements that are compounded. In other words, it's compounded, and those elements arise and pass away due to underlying causes, so they are all empty of any absolute self-arising existence. Okay, so you see the movement here? You know, I know we're already in the deep end of the pool. Can you believe it? It's not even 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm laying this stuff on you. But oh well. So we've gone from no soul, okay? In the Buddhist view, there are processes, and that's a whole conversation, that move from body to body, life to life, incarnation to incarnation, okay? Whether that's true or not is a different matter, okay? But we've moved from no soul, metaphysically, to no psychological essence, no entity inside psychologically, to, by extension, everything's empty. Everything is empty of absolute self-arising nature. Now, here's an important point. And I'll wrap up my deep end of the pool thing here with this one. The word empty can be understood, or emptiness can be understood in two different ways. One way is that it's an adjective. In other words, it's an attribute of something. That, for example, the ox cart is empty of absolute self-arising nature because it's comprised of many parts. It got assembled. Eventually, it will disappear. When you pull the parts apart, is there an ox cart there anymore? In the same way, we can imagine an emotional reaction to someone who's irritated us, let's say, let us down in some way. We're having an emotional reaction. In the moment, there are sensations, there are feelings, there are attitudes, there are thoughts, maybe there are images, there are factors that condition it, some of them brought up from our past, perhaps our childhood, all that's in play in our own psychology. The notion of emptiness is that phenomena, those phenomena arise, that are comprised of many parts and arise due to causes. It's kind of an internal psychological eddy that eventually will disperse. Right? So that's emptiness as an attribute. Then what happened, interestingly, in the Mahayana movement is that emptiness became increasingly spoken of as a thing. Not just as an adjective, not just as an attribute, but as a kind of fertile void, as a thing out of which phenomena arose and passed away. The Buddha was very reluctant, both in his ontological approach, his approach to what is reality, but in particular in his pragmatic teaching approach. He really resisted the notion of absolutes that one could cling to. People would try to get him to state that there was some kind of underlying ground or spiritual reality or fertile void that made it all okay. And he continually yanked the rug out from underneath people, minimally as a teaching strategy, as a pragmatic approach in terms of what's useful, perhaps even further, because that's really how he saw it. Whether that's true or not is a different matter we get to see for ourselves, right? But he argued really strongly against this idea of some kind of underlying essence. Right? So you see this tension between early Buddhism, which is profoundly deconstructivist. The Buddha was a pre-modern postmodernist. You know, his strategy, pragmatically, as a teaching strategy, was to continually return people to their own experience and to see what causes suffering in their own experience and what causes the end of suffering, and to encourage people and help people to become increasingly disenchanted with their own experience, to kind of not be against it, not be disgusted by it, but rather just waking up from the spell, from the enchantment of their own experience. That was his fundamental strategy, and there's a fair amount of controversy, you may know about it, in Buddhism today around this fundamental question. You know, is emptiness an adjective or a noun? But it's not about the linguistics. It's really, is there some kind of underlying something or other, the Buddhakaya, the Dharmakaya, the ground, right, that is the basis for all phenomena, including conscious experience? Okay. That was a lot. I can't believe I just did that. Yeah. All right, so that's 2,500 years of Buddhism, Rich Hansen's take at least, informed by my own teachers. it's worth it. You have a question or comment about this, and then we'll get more into a frame thing. Yeah, please.
Yeah, just as long as it's this thick.
Thick is right.
Yes, from a Western science point of view, you know, the only thing that seems to me to kind of like not jive with all this is the concept of numbers, the concept of the zero and a one. And where do you think the Buddha would come down on whether those are real or not?
I don't know what you mean.
Oh, okay. Well, they seem.
Can you
like
all hear her? Because I will not do justice to this.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Because
you're doing great.
Okay. They seem to me like self-existing.
Numbers.
Just at least the concept of zero and one, on which all of mathematics is built. It seems like they're self-existing, and that they existed before the Big Bang. And I mean, this is sort of the way that we build up the scientific world, is from those two concepts. And so, do they not have any inherent essence, or are they? Did the Buddha ever say anything about that?
As I said last night, I avoided philosophy classes in college. One, because they were hard, and two, because at the end of the day, I wasn't sure they added much value. I think. For me, they added value in terms of the precision, the clarity, and also in ethics. I think philosophy has added a lot. But these kind of questions, I just don't know. And so I don't have a strong opinion myself. If I get it right, for me, there's an important distinction between. So let's, since we are at the deep end of the pool, and then I'm going to work my way to the shallow end. You can't believe how quickly. Okay, so. One could think that, I'll just do it like this, trying not to spill with my prop. One view is that there really is a thing here. Okay? There's a thing here. The other view is that's called materialism, this fundamental philosophical stance. Right? El Capitan's really there, the center of the moon is really there, whether anybody apprehends it or not. There's materiality. The other view is that, it's all made up. It's all in the mind. Again, a little detail that you see this movement sometimes in how people talk about it, especially in Tibetan Buddhism. And there's this movement from saying that since we can never know completely what this thing is, and any idea of it can always be deconstructed further, right? Because there's an because we can never know what a thing is, it doesn't actually, it only exists in the mind. And I think that's a category error. And I don't think that's actually what Nagarjuna taught and stuff like that. All right? But you'll see this movement very often, that simply because we can't completely know what it is, or we can only know it in our mind. We never know the thing itself. All we know is our perception of it. All we know is the virtual reality that presumably the body and brain construct. Well, since all that we know is constructed in the mind, therefore it doesn't actually exist. And I think that's a category error. Because in principle, it could exist, even though we only know it through our perceptions of it. Okay? That's actually, for me, been a useful bit of clarity. And you'll see that confusion to me in a lot of writings, particularly coming out of Tibetan stuff, which many scholars think is an error. It's not really what the early Tibetan teachers said. Okay, that said, there is either a cup or there isn't. I've had too many stoner conversations as a sophomore in college.
What if we're just like a dream isn't giant, just about to wake up?
You know, I don't want to go there. It's above my pay grade. We can't prove it. I'm not going to argue about it. There either is one or it isn't. We either make it up in our mind or it really has objective reality independent of consciousness. I think it has objective reality, independent of, let's say, ordinary human, you know, or animal apperception of it, consciousness of it. Okay. So we have stuff. Now I'm going to work in the frame that there really is stuff. Okay. Then the next question is, do categories, one cup compared to two cup, right? So we have one cup. Here are two cups. Can you see two cups over here? We'll call them both cups. one cup, two cups. Plato, for example, would say that that category, that idea, that pure form, in a sense, one distinct from two, exists in its own right. And in some sense, exists much as the materiality of the cup presumably exists, right? That's kind of what you're getting at.
Yep.
Me no no, above my pay grade,
yeah.
To answer that question, don't know. I'm a little reluctant to go there myself. I think things exist, and then animals, particularly sophisticated animals, lay concepts upon them.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so we have this realm of conceptualization, even rudimentary conceptualization, like certain, like, you know, fairly intelligent animals like corvids, crows, and ravens can do fairly sophisticated things involving counting. Certainly, you know, smarter primates like the great apes, part of the great apes, you know, chimpanzees, orangutans, and gorillas, and so forth, bonobos as well. You know, we can do fairly amazing things, but I'm just, part of it for me is it's a pragmatic strategy. I'm trying to move out of conceptualization, even though I'm doing a lot of it right now in my own practice, and move closer and closer, as I think the Buddha and other teachers have taught, to the bare experiencing of things, you know, prior to conceptualization, especially to part of linguistic conceptualization. So for that reason, I'm a little leery of that line. It may be true, right? But I'm a little leery of it. That's all I'll say about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I won't argue with you now.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't argue anyway because I don't know enough to argue. Okay, so I'm going to keep going, all right? But that was actually a good foundation conceptually, okay, I think, for what we're doing here. So this is what I hope to cover in this day and a half workshop. And I really encourage you, I'm assuming you'll be here tomorrow. I really encourage you to do the whole thing. I'm thinking this as a whole. All right. What I often will do is teach this workshop in one day. It always feels too compressed in one day. It's kind of like I'm just jamming a lot of stuff in. I love the fact that I can unpack it a little bit. So I want to move through these first two bullets fairly quickly as kind of a frame here. And under the heading of the power of mindfulness, fairly soon we'll do a meditation. And I'll suggest 7 neurally informed factors for steadying the mind. Because it's not that easy to steady the mind. We didn't evolve to have a steady mind. We evolved to have skittery, distractible attention to really discern threats and opportunities. And then we're going to get into the meat of the matter right in here. What is the ordinary, particularly in the West, assumption about the nature of I? And what's our actual experience? So we'll do an experiential practice here. Then we'll talk about as self or selfing manifests in the brain and the implications of that for the ultimate idea that maybe the notion of I is not merely empty. In other words, that it lacks some kind of absolute arising nature. Maybe it doesn't exist at all. And to preview something, a horse exists. Its ultimate nature is empty in the technical meaning of the word here, that a horse is made up of many parts, that arises due to causes. It's coextensive, ultimately, out into the allness of everything, this horse, right? But it exists, presumably, in the sense that that cup has some material existence, independent of our perception of it. But a unicorn, sorry to disappoint, I don't think unicorns exist, okay? So there's a distinction there. A unicorn is a phenomenon in the mind, you know, a picture in a book, a computer graphics generated image in a cool movie, concept, you know, it arises, okay? Its representations are also empty. We could make a horse look like a unicorn by gluing a horn to it or somehow manipulating it. But at the end of the day, I don't think unicorns exist. So we're going to be exploring the idea that at the end of the day, the notion of I, or the sense of I, is not merely empty as an experience, but that which it points to does not even actually exist. That's that territory there. And then I want to explore the paradox that, this is the shrink in me talking here, the psychologist, the paradox that it's when, as a psychological creature and a deeply social creature, when we don't feel really appreciated as a person, if we don't feel really loved and prized over here, that actually generates a lot of selfing, a lot of me, myself, and I in. And paradoxically, when we feel loved and cherished and prized, when we get what in psychology is called normal, narcissistic supplies, when we get those, when we start filling up the hole in our heart with those, using methods such as I spoke of last night, of deliberately taking in the good, to really register positive experiences in the body, in emotional memory, so they really get woven into us, so they stick to our ribs, that if we do that progressively, if we feel loved, if we feel special, if we feel like a good person deep down inside, that actually that helps undo, it reduces the causes that produce egoity, vanity, possessiveness, and taking life personally. So I'm going to explore that with you all pretty experientially. And then we'll go into various ways to take life less personally, and then on Sunday wrap up with an exploration of this particular sutta, which is where we started here. To put this in context, this is fairly well known in Buddhism. Bahia was a teacher in the Buddha's day and age. He was, by all accounts, a very mature spiritual practitioner. He heard that there was someone teaching that who was fully realized, so Bahia traveled a far distance to see the Buddha. He encountered the Buddha apparently on alms round or coming back from alms round. And Bahia came up to the Buddha and said, please, noble sir, may I have your teachings? And the Buddha said, not now, Bahia. And for whatever reason, including just busy, this is not the place, I'm going, you know, not now. Bahia pleaded a second time, please, noble sir, may I have your teachings? The Buddha said again, not now, Bahia. And then Bahia asked a third time, please, sir, may I have your teachings? And apparently, traditionally, if you get three, you know, please in, before the king's guards drag you away, they're supposed to grant your wish. Okay, so the Buddha basically then said to him, and you can just feel the moment, right? The Buddha's busy. He recognizes Bahia is really far along the path. And for me, it's kind of a moment, I imagine, like De Niro in some Taxi Driver moment. You want the teachings? You really want the teachings? All right, here are the teachings. So he says, boom. In, so, Bahia, you want my teachings? You should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. To the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, the thought, the felt, the emotive, the wanted, there should be only the cognized. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen. Only the heard in reference to the heard. Only the sensed in reference to the sensed. Only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there's no you in that. There's no I in that. When there's no you in that, there's no you there at all. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between you, the two. In other words, there's no you anywhere, because the you, the I, is only an arising phenomenon. And if it's not constructed in experience, it doesn't exist. Right? This, just this, is the end of all suffering. That's the teaching. To practice such that we don't add selfing to moment experiencing of things, to the moment apprehension of the bare form of things, we don't add I to what's called the hedonic tone or the feeling tone of experience that is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. We don't add I to the perception of things, the knowing of what they are, that that's a cup, and this is a remote control, and this is a human body. We don't add I to that perception, nor do we add I to all the various mental formations, all the thoughts, the emotions, the images, the psychodynamics, and all the rest of that. arising in the mind. We don't add me to that, right? Nor do we even add I to consciousness itself, to awareness itself. We don't add I to that. And that, just that, according to the Buddha, is the end of all suffering, which is a remarkable claim. He's linking there the construction and the insistence upon there being an I in the mind. He's linking that to the fundamental sources of suffering. He's linking that to craving. In other words, when there's no I, there's no one to crave. There's no entity, no being inside to crave anything at all. Thus, the end of all suffering. Wow. Wow. Right between the eyes. According to the account, Bahia was enlightened on the spot. And then, with some high drama, as the story concludes, a little bit later, Bahia was wandering around, and he got into a situation where a bull apparently spotted him and was aggressive and gored him and killed him. Which is a little bit of an argument for, if you're going to be enlightened, be careful about red lights, have your friends walk you across the street if need be, and notice where the bulls are who are aggressive and have horns. All right. And the Buddha was told this, and he said, you know, oh, darn. And, well, at least he was awakened before he passed away. Okay. So, this is pretty far out. And so, me, kind of a scratching and clawing methods guy, down in the trenches, I'm thinking, okay, I'm taking the Buddha at his word, right? I think of the Buddha with no disrespect. He was described as the great physician, someone who would identify a malady, diagnose its cause, and then lay out a path of treatment. So the Buddha says to me, hey, folks, this is the path of treatment at its pith, at its deep essence. Well, I'm going to be asking myself, how can I actually do that more and more and more and function more and more without adding I to the contents of experience? Okay. So, those are the topics. Ready to get going? Any questions about the day? Okay, so some perspectives kind of quickly. We're going to explore the center of these three circles. This is also where we explored last night. Neuroscience, psychology, and contemplative practice. I think if you get different perspectives pointing at the same thing, gives you confidence that there's really a there there. Also, it proposes new kinds of methods. It gives us a chance to mine what contemplative practice might say about psychology, or what psychology might say about brain science, or what brain science might say about contemplative practice. But if we do that, we need to be very careful that we, as I said earlier, that we avoid some of the pitfalls in the glitteriness of brain science. Brain science is a baby science. And as you can see in the text here, again, a fairly well-known text, the Buddha wandered around and came to the village of the, I believe, the Kalimas, Kalimas, whatever. Anyway, and they said to him, basically, sir, we have all these teachers wandering through, and they all tell us stuff, and they all say they're right. Except they contradict each other. How do we know any one of them is true? Frankly, including you, right? What's interesting is the Buddha did not, he wasn't angry at that. He wasn't dismissive. He really respected the query. And he said, if you want to know what's true, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts, by logic, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cognition, by the acceptance of a view, after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think, this is our teacher. Wow, that's a real list. But when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise. The wise is a code synonym for awakened beings. These things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them. In other words, know the tree, as Jesus said 500 years later, judge the, ye shall know the tree by its fruits. Judge things by their results, pragmatically. The Buddha was interested in what is true, but primarily, that's the secondary concern for him, what's true. He was primarily interested in what works, right? And what works in reference to, as he said, I teach you only one thing, suffering in its end. What works in terms of leading to the end of suffering and the true end, the complete, ineradicable end of suffering. Okay. The other thing to point out is that it is still a great mystery how we're having conscious experience. It's said in science that there are three great puzzles or mysteries that remain. One is, why is there something rather than nothing at all? In other words, what caused the Big Bang? No one really knows. Second great mystery is, what's the so-called Grand Unified Theory? I love the acronym, GUT, G-U-T. The Grand Unified Theory that ties together general relativity on the one hand and quantum mechanics on the other, which are very powerful inside their silos, yet at their foundations seem to contradict each other in some ways. What's the theory that ties all that together? What's the complete account of materiality? No one knows. And the third great mystery, it's called the hard problem, is how are we doing this right now? How are we sensing what we're sensing, seeing what we're seeing, hearing what we're hearing, thinking, feeling, hoping, dreaming, suffering, the totality of conscious experience? No one knows. It's increasingly clear how the movements of the mind, including conscious experience, correlate with, co-relate with, co-arise with movements of neural activity, and how movements of neural activity correlate with changing experiential phenomena. That's increasingly clear, down to an extreme level of minutiae, really, particularly in terms of animal studies, where, setting aside the ethical question here, I'm just reporting the results, there can be a lot of very specific manipulations of the underlying neural processes and capabilities of that animal, and you can infer from its behavior what's really going on in its mind as well. So the dots are increasingly connecting with each other, but there's this fundamental explanatory gap between the movements of the meat and the experience, for example, of the color red, what's called the qualia of experience. There are fundamental subjective phenomenological qualities. The taste of pepper, right? The smell of an orange peel, or the feeling of love in the heart for someone. No one knows. That's a great mystery. As Tenzin Palmo says here, she's an English woman who spent a dozen years on retreat in a cave in Tibet, as well as a lot of other retreat time. She said, you know, we don't know what a thought is, even though we're thinking all day long. So even though we're going to try to explore pretty deeply, you know, the nature of the mind and particularly the nature of personal identity, at the end of the day, I think it's really important to be humble, to be modest about it all. Okay. So then, mindfulness, as we kind of move toward doing a practice here. So as I said last night, attention is a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. Also, as I said last night, the movements of the mind leave lasting traces in the brain. In other words, as we think, as we feel, as we hope and dream, that creates neural structure, particularly with repetition. In the saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. The fleeting flows of thoughts and feelings leave lasting traces behind. The brain is continually changing its structure. The only real question is it for better or worse? And who's doing the changing? Is that structure being molded by forces outside of us, media, other people, the relics of our own childhood? Or is that structure being shifted over time through our own wholehearted and wise efforts? Okay. So the key to changing the structure of the brain is to get control of attention. Because while neurons that fire together, wire together, do so throughout the nervous system, including in areas that are inaccessible to consciousness, neuroplasticity is turbocharged for what's in the field of focused attention. Therefore, attention is like a vacuum cleaner, because whatever we rest attention upon has heightened potency to sculpt the brain. Getting control of that spotlight / vacuum cleaner is therefore a very important thing. That's why William James, the godfather of American psychology, said over a century ago, the education of attention would be the education par excellence. the preeminent training of attention is through mindfulness practices. And the paragon, if you will, of mindfulness practices is meditation. So how do we do this, though? How do we get control of this skittery spotlight? And that's where meditation comes in. So in a moment, what I'd like to do with you, if you're up for it, is a meditation. It'll take probably 20-ish minutes. We'll start with just kind of calming. And then I'll introduce seven neural factors, seven practices, I should say, that are neurologically informed for their impact on the mind in terms of helping us steady this spotlight slash vacuum. So you want to try it? Want to do a practice? Like all practices, this is my generic disclaimer. Take care of yourself. Go your own way. Feel very free to ignore what I say. Like that. Okay? All right. So how many of you this is a courage moment. Have any of you never meditated in your entire life? It's okay if you did. Okay, semi-good. All right, good. I'm really happy about this, actually. So meditation is simple. We all meditate routinely. In other words, basically when we meditate, we're present in this moment. It's easy to be present in this moment for one exhalation. The trick is to be present for the exhalation and the inhalation that follows, and then for another 100 breaths or so in a row, right? That's the trick. So it's simply a matter of being present. Typically what we do, one does when one is meditating, is find some object of attention to rest upon. And by the way, meditation includes prayer under the general heading of contemplative practice. I'm staying, for our purposes here, inside a Buddhist frame, which is essentially agnostic with regard to the divine, the transcendental. But if you want to bring that in too, you're very, very welcome to do that. Okay? So in this context, it helps to have an object of attention. That object typically is the sensations of breathing. If there's anything about breathing that's uncomfortable for you as an object of attention, as there is often for people who have any kind of painful history, particularly a traumatic history, it's really okay to pick something else, such as a different body sensation or a simple saying like peace or may all beings be happy, or perhaps an image, or even just simply a feeling like gratitude, and let gratitude be the object of attention. It's really okay. The Buddha mentioned, by the way, many different objects of attention that are to be evaluated pragmatically, not in a doctrinaire or ideological or rigid dogmatic kind of basis, but in terms of does it help lead to the end of suffering? Okay, so we pick an object of attention. I'll refer to the breath as the object of attention. Feel very free to use a different object of attention. People register their breath sometimes at different places in the body, such as the rise and fall in the abdomen, or the sensations around the upper lip or the outside of the nose, whatever works for you. Some people more get a sense of the breath as a whole. That's perfectly fine. So there's that part. And also what we do when we meditate is, in addition to a certain willfulness, especially in the beginning, of trying to stay with the process in a gentle but firm way. You know, there's a Zen saying that we should be with our minds like the rider of a horse, a skillful rider of a horse, neither too tight nor too loose a rein. Another famous metaphor in Buddhism, you may know it, is a student of the Buddha came and said, my meditation's not going very well, and it's not happening. And the Buddha knew that this was a musician who played the lute, or some Indian equivalent. And he said, well, how do you play your lute? Do you tighten your strings really super tight, or do you keep them super loose? And the musician said, no, I tune them just to the middle place, just the right place. The Buddha said, yeah, that's how you should be with meditation. Mm-hmm. Okay? So we pick some object and stay with it. It was a bit of a top-down effort, that kind of just right place. And along the way, it's perfectly good to, it's encouraged to, open to, and gently encourage from time to time, other supportive factors, like allowing the body to kind of relax and settle, right? Or encouraging a growing tranquility. or bringing a kind of spaciousness in, a sense of openness and spaciousness in which mental phenomena arise and pass away. Or from time to time, checking the attitude in the mind. You know, what's the attitude here? Am I efforting and struggling right now? Or on the other hand, am I just kind of kicking back and being way too casual about this? Just checking in. These things can help too. Bringing a kind of wholeheartedness to it, an emotive quality, a warm-heartedness to the process. These can be nice things to bring in. The trick, of course, is to bring them in that Goldilocks way, that just right, not too tall, not too short, not too hot, not too cold kind of way, where we're opening to and encouraging from time to time these other helpful factors without getting effortful and stressed out and striving related to them. That's basically the gist of meditation. Okay, so on the basis of that, let's begin. And we'll start by just gathering yourself. You can leave your eyes open or closed. If they're open, people tend to let the eyes be quite relaxed and just sort of aware of what may be in the visual field, 6-8 feet roughly in front of oneself. If you find yourself getting sleepy or spacing out, it sometimes can help to open the eyes or to sit a little straighter. Posture helps a bit. It's important not to be too rigid about it. You want to find a posture that's both comfortable and alert. And you're coming home. There's a quality of coming into presence with yourself. There are different aims for different meditations. The aim for this meditation is a growing steadiness of mind. So there's a sustained breath after breath, minute after minute, 10-minute interval after 10-minute interval of sustained presence. That's what we're going for here. We're strengthening the muscle of attention in this particular meditation. This is more of a concentration practice as a form of meditation, where there's a real emphasis on staying with some object of attention, such as the sensations of breathing, and persisting in that presencing of that object of attention in awareness, moment after moment, minute after minute. So I'll be quiet here for a minute or so as you kind of gather yourself and settle in. All right, so continuing the practice, I'll offer 7 suggestions with a little bit of quiet in between each one for you to try them. And then at the end of the 7 suggestions, for 5 minutes, I'll suggest that you really stay with your object of attention, such as the breath. So for the very first suggestion, set an intention for this meditation. You can do so both top-down and bottom-up. A top-down intention has a feeling of a kind of instruction to yourself, often with language such as steadying the mind or being with the breath. And even more powerfully, you can set an intention from the bottom up, whereby you get a feeling inside yourself of what it would be like to fulfill the intention. In other words, you get a feeling inside of a steady mind, perhaps by imagining or modeling or quote-unquote channeling someone who is a model for you of steadiness of mind, like a teacher, perhaps the Buddha himself. You're in this bottom-up way, you're kind of grounding yourself in the intention in a very felt way, as if it has already been achieved. So exploring this for yourself for the next moments here, establish an intention for this meditation. And as you do these practices, as you follow my suggestions, two things will be happening in the mind. You'll be both doing the suggestion and also observing what happens when you do, being aware of what it's like to try that suggestion or to be aware of whatever other reactions might arise with regard to the suggestion. Which is the case, of course, with any kind of practice. And so then, to the second suggestion, really relax. Get a sense of resting, of setting down cares and concerns. One way to relax is to take several really long exhalations, at least twice as long as the duration of an inhalation. So, for example, it would be like inhaling 2, 3, exhaling 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, inhaling. However you like, focusing on some long exhalations for a bit, also relaxing your tongue, and doing whatever else you know to do to help yourself and help your body to relax. Third suggestion, open to and gently encourage warm-heartedness. In particular, open to and receive experiences of feeling cared about. Without strain or effort, bring to mind one or more beings, could be a human or a pet or a spiritual being, in the present or in the past or even a group of people, one or more beings that really give you the feeling of being cared about. You're activating in the mind right now a wholesome factor of feeling cared about and trying to help that to arise in the mind by opening to the sense of being liked or included, or really seen, or respected, or prized, or cherished and loved. Taking a moment here to encourage and open to a growing sense of feeling cared about. Relationships need not be perfect, as long as one slice of the relationship pie is that this other being genuinely cares about you. And you can help yourself increasingly feel that, maybe with a sense of warmth in the heart area, a softening in the face. And you can also perhaps have your own sense of caring about other beings, your own compassion and kindness and love for other beings. It mingles with a feeling of being cared about. And then for the fourth suggestion, letting whatever sense you have of feeling cared about or feeling loving yourself, moving a little bit to the background of awareness, see if you can help yourself to feel as safe as you reasonably can. Being aware, for example, of being in a protected setting right now, among good people, with resources inside yourself and in your life that you can draw upon if things are difficult, such that there really is the basis for letting go of any unnecessary anxiety, being aware of any background uneasiness, any background guarding or bracing that's not reasonable, it's not necessary, and helping yourself increasingly let it go and encouraging in this secluded environment a growing experience of safety, of being unthreatened, not at war with any being, increasingly safe and at peace. Softening and opening in the body, letting go of unnecessary guarding or bracing or defending. Anything that's unnecessary, that's not reasonable, helping it fall away. A growing sense of safety, feeling unthreatened. Helping this feeling to grow in your mind. Sense of safety, whatever has been arisen here, to move to the background of awareness. Moving to the fifth suggestion, which is to open to and encourage some positive emotion, such as a sense of well-being, ordinary everyday well-being, or a sense of gladness or gratitude, or even happiness. Thinking of things that make you feel happy, whatever those may be. As always, without strain or stress or clinging, but with willfulness and a kindness toward oneself, encouraging some positive emotion to arise, and actually encouraging it to become as full and even as intense as possible for the next few moments here. Thinking of things that really help you feel happy, that bring even some sense of energy or aliveness or vitality to you that feels emotionally positive. These experiences of happiness or well-being or positive emotion may be subtle, and yet they can still quite pervade the mind as you give yourself over to them, maybe even encouraging them through what's called embodied cognition, such as what Thich Nhat Hanh suggests is a half smile. A little bit of a smile, not a phony smile, but a little bit of a smile, perhaps, to help yourself, if you like, open to some positive emotion here. Maybe there's simply a growing sense of contentment, of a pleasant fullness and ease and alrightness with the moment as it is. And that's fine, that's great. There may be pain, there may be fear, there may be sorrow amidst the well-being. Contained within it, though, like some kind of thing bobbing up and down in a much larger lake or ocean even of well-being. And then moving on to the sixth suggestion, allowing any kind of positive emotion to move a bit to the background of awareness, explore what it's like to regard your own experience from a panoramic view, from a kind of bird's eye view, perhaps as if you're atop a mountain looking out to a vast plain before you of sounds or thoughts or sensations. Moving through awareness, passing through a great open space of awareness, like flocks of birds or fireflies or shooting stars, coming and going in a vast and edgeless space, therefore a boundless space of awareness. See if you can explore that sense of awareness like a vast space in which contents of mind arise and pass away. seventh suggestion, continuing to relate to experience as appearances coming and going in a vast space of awareness. In the seventh suggestion, sense and intend that whatever benefits of this meditation there may be are sinking into you. Both the positive qualities of mind and heart that have arisen so far, those are sinking in. Those are weaving your way into the fabric of your being. Those are coming in. And as well, as the meditation proceeds, there too, whatever future benefits may be present in your practice, those too are sinking in. You are taking in the good of this particular practice. So, for example, right now, whatever positive experiences you're having, whatever quality of peacefulness or steadiness of mind or clarity of mind or well-being, breath by breath, it is going into you, weaving its way into the fabric of your brain and your being. Like water coming into a sponge, perhaps, or the warmth of a cup of cocoa moving into the hands. As children, I talk about a jewel going into the treasure chest of the heart, or simply a knowing that the residues, the positive residues of the states of mind you have cultivated here are sinking into you to become a part of you that you can take with you wherever you go. Basis of these seven suggestions and whatever steadiness of mind you've cultivated so far, for the next 5 minutes, see if you can stay continuously present with your object of attention. Let's say the sensations of breathing. It's all right, for example, if it is breathing, for attention to move a little bit from a sensation in one part of the body to a sensation in a different part of the body, or to the sensations of breathing as a whole. But in general, it helps to not have attention skitter around too much and to actually stay with one object of attention as a kind of way to build the muscle of attention. So choosing your object of attention, finding it, let's say it's the sensations of breathing, being aware continuously of an exhalation, and then applying your attention to the beginning of the next inhalation and sustaining attention throughout the course of that inhalation, giving yourself over to it as a kind of renunciation practice for 5 minutes. Or you abandon all else. You don't struggle with things other than your object of attention. You simply don't give them energy. And you keep foregrounding in awareness your object of attention, such as the sensations of breathing. Applying attention to the beginning of each inhalation and exhalation, and then sustaining attention over the course of that inhalation or exhalation for the next 5 minutes. taking another moment to be mindful of whatever steadiness of mind is here for you, cultivated by the causes that you put on the fire, the good causes of steadying the mind. Taking a moment to register what greater steadiness of mind is like, sensing that you are taking in this state of steadiness of mind, whatever is there for you, so that you can find your way back to it more easily again. Okay, finishing up the meditation. Coming back. I thought what we could do is segue into a break right now. And as a teacher of mine, Gil Fronstall once advised me, you can explore meditating through the formal end of a sitting, kind of like a runner runs through the tape of the finish of the race. So you can meditate through standing up in a moment, meditate through using the bathroom, meditate through chatting with friends, getting some fresh air, what have you. And then how about coming back in 15 minutes at 11:15? So see you then.